You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 142, The Mines of Potosí, Part 2. Before starting today's episode, I wanted to quickly let you know that the latest Friends of the Podcast episode was released yesterday. This one is designed to complement this series on Potosí by looking more closely at one aspect of life in the mines, namely the strange deity whose statue is worshipped by the miners and who is a combination of the Christian devil and the indigenous Andean god Supai, who predates the devil in this part of the world. If you stick around to the end of this episode, you can listen to a few minutes of that one to give you a taste of what you get by signing up. Of course, you also get access to the growing back catalogue of special episodes, as well as all future ones. The story of Potosí starts in the year 1545. Pizarro had killed the Inca Emperor Atahualpa 12 years before. It is 7 years since he had killed his former partner, Almagro, and just 4 since he himself was killed by Almagro's supporters. Manco Inca had only just died, and of course the Neo-Inca state is still in existence. It will be for decades to come. The heart of the new Spanish viceroyalty is southern and central Peru. Almagro had crossed Bolivia and attempted to settle in Chile, although this colony was quickly abandoned, and at this point Valdivia is midway through his attempt to re-establish colonial control there. The civil war between the Pizarro and Almagro factions has delayed expansion and consolidation into today's Bolivia. La Paz won't be founded until a few years later. The barren environment of the Altiplano is unattractive to Spanish settlers. It appears to have little use in terms of agriculture. Near Potosí, however, a relatively small silver mine which the Inca had used, was shown to the Spanish in 1538. Silver is better than agriculture to a conquistador. Spanish priorities are encapsulated in the name of the tiny, remote regional capital which they have just established. Today it's called Sucre, after an independence leader, but the Inca settlement, which they had repurposed, was named Chuquisaca, which translates to something like pile of silver. The Spanish then called this town La Plata, the silver, although there wasn't actually much silver in the immediate area surrounding the town. Potosí was then a lonely and empty place at the time that the silver was discovered there. It was on the fringes of Spanish control, and attempts at expansion were focused elsewhere. Every great metal discovery has a legend attached to it, and Potosí is no different. As is often the case, there are competing versions of the folktale. All of them involve the discovery happening through luck and chance. Some involve stories of saintly apparitions by either Catholic or indigenous religious figures. An indigenous man named Guanca is often said to have been the one to find out that the Cerro Rico was made of silver. According to some, he had been a high-ranking servant of the Inca royal family, and he is commonly said to have served a powerful Spaniard post-conquest, possibly the man who had been given those existing silver mines, but who was finding them to be unproductive. Years later, a Spanish priest wrote about a dying man he had given the last rites to, and who gave an account of discovering the mines. This is the most we have in terms of contemporary historic accounts. One day, the discoverer ended up on the Cerro Rico. He might have been chasing a llama or deer, which he hoped to catch for food. He may have been looking for a shrine to the indigenous god of the wind. He somehow lost his companion, and then many accounts say that he was blown over by a great wind. As he stood up, he recognized that the dirt which covered his hands was a type found at rich silver deposits. Another variation has it that he camped there, and the very earth was so full of the metal that he noticed molten silver developing inside the fire. There are multiple stories of supernatural voices and powers. That god of the wind blowing others over once they came to take a look, or Christian figures warning the man that this silver was reserved for Spaniards, not for him. Some of the legends talk of the man having trouble convincing his Spanish master to actually investigate his find. It is possible that the deposits within the hill were not truly discovered that day. The red of the soil is a good indicator of minerals, and we've already seen that the Inca did mine nearby. They don't appear to have excavated here, however, even if they knew about it, at least not on a large scale. There are geologists who argue that there is evidence in nearby lakes, suggesting some small-scale mineral exploitation. Given that the Inca Empire was a relatively short-lived affair, if this is true, it may have been done by cultures which predate them. Geographical features like mountains often have spirits and deities attached to them in Andean religious systems, so it's possible that the Inca knew that there were metals here, but avoided mining for religious reasons. Perhaps they didn't want to disturb a supernatural being who inhabited the mountain. Despite it very quickly becoming apparent that this was a significant find, the civil wars in the Viceroyalty of Peru meant that its very earliest years were not marked by an overnight silver rush, like many precious metal finds across history. We looked at this a bit at the end of the Conquest of Peru series, and I'll probably do episodes on it one day. But for now we need to know that Pizarro's sons were the source of the trouble, and that they used other nearby mines to fund their battles. When they were gone, and a new viceroy was fully in charge, sent personally by the king in Spain, the conditions were right for the growth of Potosí. In 1550, 5 years after the initial discovery, mining was already in full swing. Soon after this, Viceroy Toledo set up, or rather repurposed, the meter system. This system is fascinating, and probably deserving of its own episode at some point. It was established by the Inca as a way of obtaining labour from conquered peoples. Every community was obliged to provide a type of tax in the form of manual labour, and this built the infrastructure of empire, bridges and roads, for example. This was an exploitative system, held up by the threat of force, or the memory of force previously used during Inca conquests. It did, however, have roots in Andean systems of reciprocity and spiritual understandings of the world. Communal work and reciprocal obligations, which are returned at a later date, are an important part of the Andean worldview, and they are believed to mirror the patterns of nature. Today, similar systems still exist on small-scale local levels within indigenous communities. In these systems, everyone is required to come together to donate labour and to build things which benefit the community as a whole. Sometimes these obligations take the form of time and participation in local political decisions. I personally believe that this is a positive incarnation of these kinds of systems. Everyone has a say, and this improves the local area, while at the same time building a sense of community. In the West, it's very common to hear people say that community is dead and that nobody knows their neighbours anymore. We like to outsource our politics to councillors, mayors, and members of parliament rather than participate ourselves beyond voting every few years. Perhaps this can be linked to the current disillusionment with politics and politicians. Anyway, that's a sidetrack. The Inca version of the meter was exploitative, and for the Spanish, it provided a perfect, ready-made institution for them to exploit the silver of Potosí and the other mines in the region. At any one time, 1/7 of a community's available labour-capable population was required to report for meter service. Sometimes they were sent to work on agricultural estates or to public building projects. It was always ensured, however, that the mines had sufficient labour, and as the mines ate so many people, that demand for labour was very high. Viceroy Toledo had arrived in 1569, and he was responsible for the boom at Potosí and the expansion of the meter system to fuel it. Toledo was an interesting figure. He was certainly among the leaders of Peru who did the most to develop the colony, especially its mines. He left the Viceroyalty of Peru in a much more developed state than he found it. A lot of this was built, however, on the exploitation of indigenous and African peoples. He put a lot of effort into consolidating and strengthening the administration of the still fledgling and underdeveloped viceroyalty, and this allowed for greater wealth extraction and taxation. He also oversaw the final defeat of the Neo-Inca state. But despite all of this, he would be accused of corruption relating to the taxes being sent back to Spain, and he died in prison there. Under the Inca meter system, people usually performed the required work on projects close to home, but under Toledo's modified version, people from all over the viceroyalty were sent to Potosí. The health and ultimate fate of those drafted to work was unimportant, and studies have shown notable drops in the indigenous male population of the region, which can largely be linked to conditions in the mine. A Spanish friar, who was one of the first to give an account of Potosí, he was actually there before Toledo, and who would later be proclaimed a saint, and so is now known as Santo Tomás, visited the mine in 1550 and wrote the following about it. It must have been about 4 years during which this land was about to be lost, here he's referring to the civil wars, that there was discovered a mouth of hell, into which have entered, as I say within that time, a great quantity of people, which by the greed of the Spaniards they sacrificed to their god, and these are some silver mines that they call Potosí. Another quote gives more specific information about the dangers of the mine. It was written by a mine owner in the late 1500s, who therefore had direct and detailed knowledge of the subject. Because of when he was writing, he also uses the word Indian when referring to indigenous peoples. Obviously, I wouldn't usually use that word myself, but in this case it's part of the quote. So he says, "And of the sad things that have happened to these people, of which memory is still fresh, I shall relay several to your excellency, so that you will understand the labours they suffer, and how much this ore cost them, such that we could say that it was rather blood than ore. And such was the case in the mine they call La Muñiza, in the Veta Rica, where a Spaniard, working in company with another, brought 56 Indians. With 28 he worked by day, and the rest by night. The mine was dangerous, especially in the gallery they had expanded to a large degree, such that when Francisco de Aruño entered to inspect it, he being the royal inspector at the time, knowing the risk the Indians faced, he ordered the work suspended until certain repairs necessary for security were done, even issuing a formal decree to this effect. And the owner of the mine alleged in writing that these repairs were not necessary, and that the decree had been animated by a passion against him, that the mine was quite secure, appealing and filing certain proceedings. With this, these sad people came to perish, as only 2 days later, this mine collapsed, catching all 28 Indians underground, the ones sent to work at night. And the next day in the morning, all the judges went up to the mountain, accompanied by a large number of Indians and their wives, children, and their relatives, who rent the air with their cries and wails. And so much earth and rock fell upon the buried miners, that they were unable to pull them out straight away, but rather, with the passing of time, as they cleared it away, they located them. The Spaniard was jailed, and after much trial and detention, he was condemned by the Royal Audiencia to a fine of 8,000 assayed pesos, part for the royal chamber, and the rest to be distributed among the widows according to the number of children they had. I think that quite's interesting, because it shows how dangerous and difficult the working conditions were, but also that there was some kind of system in place to protect the workers and indigenous peoples, even if that system didn't function a lot of the time. The same man also said this, "And it's common that they bring down dead workers and others with cracked skulls and broken legs, and each day in the mills they are wounded. And the simple facts of working at night, and in such a cold country, and tending to ore crushers, which is the hardest work due to the dust they get in the eyes and mouth, all of this is enough to do them great harm. And thus the hospital is full of wounded Indians, and more than 50 of them die each year, and this fierce beast swallows them alive. And at this moment, between the tribunals of the Judge of Native Affairs and the mine magistrate, they are pursuing more than 70 criminal cases related to Indian deaths." Hopefully you can begin to see how the life of a miner I described last episode from my own 21st century visit, while safer than this, is a sort of continuation of 500 years of life, work and death within and around the Cerro Rico, and why I thought it was relevant and helpful to give my account. It's not as bad as it sounds in that account by any means, but it's still pretty bad by modern standards, and the general nature of the work feels quite similar. A concrete way of illustrating the horrors of work in the mines would be the mortality rate. Calculating this is difficult though. The highest estimates put the number of fatalities over several centuries at around 8 million. Others put it in the hundreds of thousands. It's pretty much impossible to really estimate the true number. There are so many factors that cloud things. The centuries which the work took place over, the lack of record keeping, the different types of miners, some more likely to be recorded than others. Based on looking at a few different sources, I think it's reasonable to talk about millions, not thousands. But beyond that, it's difficult to say. Whatever the exact number is, finds like the mass grave of over 400 people discovered in 2014 suggest that single incidents could kill huge numbers within an instant.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
In most parts of the Spanish Americas, the indigenous people were put to work in the plantations and mines, but the Spanish often found that the mortality rate was high enough to disrupt productivity. They were literally worked to death, and death and inability to work was amplified by the old world diseases, to which the indigenous peoples had little resistance. The solution was the African slave trade, and for the most part, the empire found that people brought from Africa were better able to withstand these rigors. Slaves from Africa were also brought to work at Potosi, and so the trade is connected to this story. This is one case, however, where because of the unique climatic conditions, the indigenous peoples were found to be stronger and more effective. African people did work in the mines, but many more were brought to the city to become domestic servants in the town itself, or to drive mule trains. It's hard to find numbers when it comes to how many African people and their descendants lived in Potosi. The high prices they were sold for, however, suggests that there was perhaps not enough to meet the demand of people who wanted them. So far we've talked about those who suffered in these mines, and talked of the Spanish benefiting in the abstract. It is useful, however, to examine the issue of ownership in more detail. The Spanish crown never operated the majority of the mines. Technically, the king owned it all, but he handed it out in small portions to private citizens in exchange for a royalty. Private citizens were allowed to make claims to sections of the mountain and to explore for new veins to claim. The royalty they were required to pay was the royal fifth of all the silver the mine produced. We should then talk of mines rather than a single mine. Nobody was able to possess the whole mountain, and so lots of different people obtained rights to little bits of it and built their own tunnels. This is still how it works today, with all those cooperatives having their own mine shafts. Magistrates were employed directly by the government to keep track of all the claims and to ensure that nobody avoided taxes or encroached on anyone else's claim. Of course, it was mainly rich Spaniards who were able to put together these claims and had the finances required to obtain the workforce and equipment needed. The meter system, while state-run, was similar to the encomienda one. Mine owners were often given an allotment of meter workers for their mines. There were, though, cases of indigenous people and free Africans lodging claims and running their own mining operations. It's also important to point out that for the first couple of decades in particular, before Toledo arrived, indigenous people were perhaps the largest group who owned mines at Potosí. There is evidence of indigenous people going into partnership with Spaniards who wanted to invest but preferred to act as silent partners and live somewhere less remote and challenging. These arrangements were often fraught. The Spaniards usually had the capital and the weight of their favourable position within the empire's hierarchy, but the indigenous people had the expertise and local knowledge. The Spaniards' positions were usually stronger, but a clever indigenous person could leverage what they had. Most of these people were able to do this because they came from a special class. Just as the Spanish had reutilized the Inca meter system, they also adopted another Inca innovation, the Yanacona. These were people from conquered groups who the Inca had elevated to work as administrators. This also worked well for the Spanish with their lack of understanding of the vast population now under their control, and so they continued to appoint people as Yanaconas, and they had much stronger rights than the rest of the indigenous population. It should also be noted that despite the danger and hard work, some people did choose to work in the mines as wage labourers, while the supply of meter and slave labour acted as a brake on their bargaining power. The death rate, unappealing nature of the work, and the sheer number of different mine operations meant that those who chose this life could negotiate a decent living, and the tradition of helping yourself to a small piece of high-grade silver at the end of each shift was a tolerated bonus. It wasn't long before the open pits were replaced by tunnels and shafts. Llamas were used to cart ore and equipment alongside mules. The work never stopped as people worked in shifts. Sometimes workers even slept in the tunnels and didn't see the surface for days at a time. Smaller but still important silver finds were discovered in various other places in the region, and we mustn't forget that the actual mining was just one part of the industry surrounding Potosí. There were all the required supporting services, people providing food, alcohol, lodgings, equipment, etc. But the other major source of work was smelting. Countless little forges covered the flank of the mountain, smoke drifting up from their courtyards. Smelting in Europe and Spain long predated Potosí, but the altitude and the lack of oxygen this implied meant that new techniques were required. Traditional European bellows could not create a hot enough fire. The guayras, as the new type of smelter which developed there became known, were based on an Inca design and used copper pipes to harness the wind, combined with clay pots and animal manure used for fuel. I'm not a blacksmith, so I'm afraid explaining it in detail is beyond me, but it did the job. This meant that many of the forges had to be built on the lower slopes of the mountain itself, or on other surrounding peaks, and this was in order to catch the wind. The fact that this technology was a pre-existing indigenous one also meant that it was mainly indigenous people operating the smelting businesses in the first few decades of Potosí's life. Anyone with the money could buy slaves, and so there were enslaved Africans working in the smelters as well as the mines. In fact, there were probably many more assigned this type of work than digging underground. Working this way appears infinitely preferable to entering the bowels of the mountain, but it was dangerous as well. Working as a smelter meant that you were constantly in contact with all sorts of poisons, mercury and lead, for example, and they came in both solid and liquid form, as well as gases and vapours, which were frequently breathed in, alongside silica dust. The machinery itself was designed to crush the ore, and it wasn't uncommon for people to find themselves crushed by accident instead. Despite the promising start, by 1569 there was a drop in activity at Potosí. The highest grade of ore was starting to run out, and it would take new methods to make the vast deposits of lesser grade silver worth mining. Once these methods were developed, basically they involved adding mercury to unlock the silver from the rocks it was encased in, the boom really began. From here on out, Potosí would be of enormous global importance for centuries. Those techniques were actually developed in Mexican silver mines, but for some reason that's a bit of a mystery, it took a few years for them to be taken up in Peru. The year in which the most silver was brought out of the mountain was still relatively early, 1592, and the numbers very slowly declined from there. This decline was so slow, though, and that highest point so high, that Potosí was a boomtown for centuries. According to some estimates, 80% of all the world's silver came from this mountain between the 16th and the 18th century. Next time, we will look further at the impact all this silver had on the world. So what follows is that sample I mentioned earlier of the most recent Friends of the Podcast episode. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to help out, one thing that's really useful is leaving a review wherever you get your podcast from. Thank you to everyone who's already done this, and thank you for listening. In the most recent of the main episodes, the first one in the series on Potosí, I mentioned my meeting with El Tío, the figure who sits just inside the entrance to the mine shafts of the Cerro Rico, the mountain sitting above the city. Today, in this episode, we're going to have a closer look at him. As we've seen in that episode, and we'll see in future ones, conditions in the mine are brutal and dangerous. This is the case today when miners work for themselves in cooperatives, and it was even more so when the Spanish controlled them, and labour was drawn from the encomienda, the repurposed meter system, or from slavery. El Tío is a fascinating reaction to both those dangers, but also the imposition of Spanish religion, and he is a result of its combination with indigenous beliefs, as well as a reaction to the situation Bolivia's indigenous people found themselves in. When I visited, we were shown into his room. The uncle, which is what El Tío means, had been carved out of the wall. It was a life-sized figure, sitting on a throne. It was immediately obvious that he was meant to resemble the Christian devil, with his big horns. There was a hole in his mouth, in which our guide placed a lit cigarette. Coca leaves were put in his lap, and some of that ridiculously strong alcohol I mentioned in the main episode was poured out for him to take a drink from. The guide pointed to some stains on the walls and floor. This was chicken blood, he told us. Sometimes chickens are sacrificed to him as well. He had colourful streamers draped all over him, and an outstretched hand, ready to receive gifts. The idea was to ask for El Tío's protection. It looked like some kind of party had taken place there, although the dingy underground room looked like the last place you'd want to have a celebration. The world underground, which we were entering, is his realm. He has the power of life and death, and he often chooses death for the miners. Afterwards, I tried to make sense of it all. I imagined the colonial missionaries telling the miners that they must follow Christianity, and explaining how God lives in the sky, but evil Satan lives underground, in a hot place, and seeks to do evil. I know now, from visits to places across Latin America, that even when conversion is achieved, it's incredibly common for elements of the old religion to remain, or for Christian concepts to be reinterpreted using pre-existing understandings. Due to its altitude, the Bolivian Altiplano is cold, but it was strikingly hot inside the mine. Given this heat and the danger, the constant deaths and injuries, it must have really felt to a forcibly converted Aymara or Quechua person that they were entering hell. Conquered and forced down the mine, given this new set of Christian stories, it must have been logical to them that it was Satan you must ask for protection as you trespassed into his world. Despite Christian aversion to sacrifices and offerings, to them this was how you asked for that protection, with gifts of things the powerful might enjoy. Like humans, spirits enjoy a good time. They enjoy coca leaves, cigarettes, strong alcohol, and meat. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. Datemyage.com.